This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station. The Health News Digest on the bigger picture. BFM 89.9.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. It's Health News Digest. I'm Tina Camilla, and joining me for this edition are Ti Xiaoyik and Lau Yahua.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. So we're going back to school. Our stories today are
one on school canteen food. The Healthy School Canteen Management Guide will be enforced this year to limit the access and availability of unhealthy food and drinks to school children.
And we'll talk about the need for clinical psychologists in schools after a suicide resulted from a theft allegation. And finally,
the final story is coming out of South Korea, where kids are named as co-authors in scientific papers. The practice is thought to give the children an edge when they are applying to university, which we all know is very competitive in South Korea.
That's what we have lined up for the hour. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
The Health News Digest on the bigger picture. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to the show. It's Health News Digest with me, Tina Camilla, Ti Xiaoyik and Lau Yahua. Our theme today is back to school. First up, suicide over theft allegations. So on February 1st, 14-year-old Vasanta Piriyev Munyandi died 2 weeks after attempting suicide.
So the teacher had accused Vasanta of stealing her phone, and the teacher had allegedly kept the girl in her office with two other teachers while threatening to take her to the police if she did not own up to the theft. The teacher also allegedly locked the student in a room for several hours before taking her home to talk to her parents. And it was while the teacher was talking to Vasanta's parents that she tragically tried to hang herself in her room. Vasanta had left a suicide note telling her parents and grandmother that she loved the teacher and did not steal her handphone. She also said that it was her own decision to attempt suicide. In further news reports after the incident, it was reported that another teacher who had taught Vasanta in the same school described her as a timid and quiet student with no disciplinary record. So it makes you wonder what made the teacher jump to such conclusions about her behavior. And in fact, underlying mental health problems are seen to be a major issue among children and adolescents today, with the National Health and Morbidity Survey 2015 finding that almost 30% of Malaysians aged 16 and above have psychiatric conditions.
Is that a high number? That's 3 in every 10 students reportedly having a psychiatric condition.
Well, not just students, right? Because it's Malaysians aged 16 and above.
So right.
It's probably going to be more of the adults if I get the population subset correct, right? I'm not sure if we have any information about the actual student population, or how many of them actually have psychiatric conditions or some sort of psychological challenges. But I would say 30% is quite a lot, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like our obesity rates too.
Obesity is a little bit higher. I think it's almost like half.
Yeah.
49.
Overweight and obesity combined is almost half.
So 30%, that means roughly 1 in 3. So one of us here probably has some kind of psychiatric condition.
Not me.
You're quick to answer. So Xiaoyik, you spoke to Dr. Philip George to talk about mental health problems among adolescents.
We're seeing a huge rise in depression and anxiety among adolescents. The family sizes are growing smaller. There's less face-to-face interaction compared to, you know, social media and other interaction. And so a lot of emphasis now is on scholastic and academic achievements, not on life skills. Sometimes it takes a toll on the individual and they have no place to turn to. Loneliness sets in, especially when parents are too busy with their own pursuits and they're in a small family, they don't have the extended family that's involved. It can also set in schools where there's bullying or there's subtle discrimination. And now we have this platform, this, you know, social gadgets and media that actually also influences how people feel about themselves and how they fit into a group as well.
It's interesting he mentioned focus on academic achievements, because that's another story that we're going to cover a little bit later on. But who do you think Vasanta could have turned to, you know, if her teacher doesn't believe her? And I'm assuming that she maybe thought that her parents might not be able to support her.
Yeah, well, I remember when I was young, right, you know, as students, teachers are really our role models. You know, other than parents, teachers are the ones that we believe in, we trust in, and we look up to. And I do remember that there were times when my teachers did not trust me for reasons that I could not understand, and I felt so betrayed. And it is true, in those circumstances, in those situations, I did not know who to turn to, because if I told my parents, it felt like something shameful. I could not turn to my teachers. I'm not even sure if the teachers would speak among themselves. And I'm not sure if I could turn to my friends, because I felt that they were also as vulnerable as I was. I mean, it was nothing serious now looking back at it. But at that time, it was very hard for me to take at the time. So yeah, in this case, looking from the outside in, I guess we could say, you know, she could turn to the counselors or to some of her best friends at least. But for the person in that situation, she would feel very weak, I would say, or helpless.
I think it's great that you brought up the role of the school counselor, though, Yao Hua, because students spend so much of their time in school. Most of their parents today are busy working. So there should be a figure of authority in school who can also provide support rather than just being somebody to be feared. So I actually spoke to Carol Chung, a registered counselor, to find out what the role of a school counselor is.
A counselor's role in school is a huge one in supporting children's mental and emotional health. And it's a role that they cannot play alone. It's a role that they can only carry out well with support from teachers and school administration. They have to work closely with disciplined teachers and other staff members. And apart from counseling, there are lots of things which a school counselor can do. Awareness campaigns on mental health issues, for example, stress, depression and anxiety, on substance abuse, on internet addiction, on bullying. A school counselor can carry out prevention programs, suicide prevention, for example, run life skills workshops for the students, dealing with stress, time management, how to deal with procrastination, emotional intelligence and emotional regulation. These are all very important skills for a person to do well in life, to thrive.
I also spoke to Carol to ask her about the right time for a student to see a school counselor.
I think the role of a counselor is to be an emotional support to the student, somebody who is sort of on the student's side. We would work with the student to identify what the issues are. And once we've unearthed underlying issues, we then begin to counsel them and we work with them to address those issues. So the issues could be poor self-esteem, lack of self-confidence, poor communication or poor social skills. And we certainly work with the students to build those soft skills to enable them to communicate better with people, both their peers as well as parents, as well as teachers.
I would love it if schools can have the capacity to provide mental health services. I just don't think that we have the resources or enough expertise to actually make that happen.
Did you guys have counsellors in your school back in the day?
I had an academic guidance counsellor, but focused only on academic development and not so much on mental health.
In high school, secondary school, the school had a section of our counsellors, but I have no memory of what services they provided. I didn't even recall if any of my friends looked them up. Well, they did come around and gave academic advice. Mm. But other than that, you know, whether they tended to psychological issues or stress, I'm not sure. But I think that's also one of the ways it should work, right? Like, I do not know who have gone for their services. I think that should be one of the ways it works. The other thing that Carol Chung said just now, that counselors would welcome students who come to them proactively. Mm. And that's great, but I find it so hard. I guess I got to qualify this because I also work with youth, teenagers now, and particularly like I'm now working with a teenager who is facing quite a bit of a depression and stuff. And I find that he found it so hard to open up and to speak to people. And I'm speaking to him in a very safe setting in his home. If it's so difficult in his own house, how much more difficult it would be in a school setting for them to, you know, come out of class. Because when would they come and meet the counselor? It's actually during class time, if I remember correctly. And once you do that, people will know, hey, where is he or she going to, you know? We are all going for our, you know, agama class or our moral education, and that person is going somewhere else, then that's very difficult.
I think there's a stigma attached to it.
Yeah, and the ability to communicate your own issues, I think...
Yeah, and especially when you're so young and you are trying to find the right words to talk about your issues, when you don't have that kind of rich vocabulary to describe your feelings. And sometimes feelings are not as straightforward as, you know, I'm sad or I'm angry. It's sometimes both sad, angry, happy at the same time. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I don't know.
Since the news about Vasanta broke, there's also been a lot of attention in the media about the role of the teacher who accused Vasanta of stealing her handphone. And there's been a lot of reaction from some teacher groups as well, including Page Parent Action Group for Education Chairperson Datin Nor Azima Abdul Rahim, who said that the teacher had taken the law into her own hands, which is dangerous not only for the students but for teachers as well. The Malacca Action Group for Parents in Education, who said that the teacher had acted against the school's SOP by detaining Vasanta for hours before taking her home to see her parents. And the NUTP, National Union of the Teaching Profession, who said that the school should have instead immediately informed Vasanta's parents of the case. And so this really brings to surface the point that teachers themselves may be ill-equipped to handle affairs that don't directly relate to students' academic activities in school. And Carol also had another important point to add here, where she says that counselors have to work with teachers to train them to identify when students are in need of support.
From what I hear from friends and kids and all that, is that students are sent to the counselor when they have done something wrong in the eyes of the school, and therefore if you go to the counselor, you're already labeled as a bad kid or a problem kid. So yes, I think that we need to be more proactive about that. I think a very important part of a school counselor's job is to give awareness sessions for teachers so that teachers can identify problems when they are just emerging rather than at some end point when some big terrible thing has happened or some crisis has happened. To help teachers to identify students in need of counseling and then to refer those students for counseling and support to the school counselor early on. And that would be, I think, the ideal role, which one school counselor per school cannot do, but maybe two or three counselors per school can do.
Wow. Two or three per school.
Oh, that's a story for another day, right?
That would be the ideal situation. Yeah.
In this case, right, it's not just Vasanta's reaction to what her teacher said, but also, I guess, a lot of counselling is due for teachers on what they can say and cannot say, what they can do or cannot do towards their students, because the impact, it's magnified when we are dealing with young children. Yeah.
Yep. All right, that's a thought to ponder upon. Meanwhile, I think we're going to go for a quick recess and have some of those canteen food.
Yeah, we're going to have a snack.
Yep, BFM 89.9.
The Health News Digest on the Bigger Picture. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to the show. It's Health News Digest. I'm Tina Camilla, joined by Tisha Ik and Lau Yahua. Earlier, we discussed the need for mental health services in schools, and now we are in the school canteen, metaphorically. Let's dig in. School canteen food. So the Star reported that the Healthy School Canteen Management Guide will be enforced this year to limit the access and availability of unhealthy food and drinks in school children. The Health Ministry's Director General, Dr. Nur Hisham Abdullah, said that the food and beverages that are not allowed to be sold are those that are high in sugar, fat and salt. I'm surprised that this has not already been done.
Yes, it's a story that resurfaces practically every year and has done so for the past several decades. And I'm sure for all of us who have been to school and eaten all that horrible canteen food before, you're probably thinking, this is still happening.
Wait, can you qualify what do you mean by horrible? As in nutrition-wise horrible, taste-wise horrible?
Oh my god, all horrible.
Wow, where did you study?
Did you think it was horrible when you were a school kid?
I would say partly retrospectively. There was this sense of, ooh, those fried wontons were always something that I would love to go for. Although, you know, there was then my mom's voice in the back of my head telling me, don't eat all that stuff, eat what I've packed for you. But in real time at that time, I don't know if you remember this, those long tubes of ice lollies
where
you
suck on them.
Those I couldn't stand even then.
Really, I love those.
You couldn't stand, like you did not like them, or you couldn't resist, or you did not like them?
I couldn't stand the taste of them even then.
I love those.
It's just sugar, isn't it?
Sugar
and water.
But it's also cold. That was the point for me. After school, after sports, I just want to
What bothered me most about those were how dirty it was for me to have to suck on the on the outside layer, those
See,
plastic
I didn't
wrapping.
Think of that. I was like six, so, you know.
You're wise beyond your years.
But in any case, we all turn out fine. You're both really, really skinny. Just saying, for our listeners' benefit.
Slim.
Although that doesn't look to be the case for many children now, because according to the National Health and Morbidity Survey, again, the prevalence of obesity among children below 18 years has increased almost twofold, from 6.1% back in 2011 to 11.9% in 2015. And shockingly, the 2012 Global School-Based Health Survey showed that 31% of secondary children drank one or more carbonated soft drinks every day, which is another regular feature in school canteens.
Worldwide, right? The global school-based.
This is a global survey, yes.
Right. I wonder if our children actually drink that much of a carbonated soft drink here. Because I know, if I remember correctly, I think in the States, they drink lots of soda.
Yeah, it's like water.
But here, I'm not sure if they... Yeah, I've not stepped into a primary school for quite some time, so...
Yeah, this survey was looking secondary at secondary school. Children. Okay. So you may see, actually, the behaviours would be different from primary children. In fact, perhaps more allowance from parents. Mm-hmm.
What are the foods that are going to be banned? Is it just all the sugary foods?
I mean, generally, those
fries, burgers,
that's the principle.
Fish balls.
Yes. Yes,
Fish balls are fine.
I suppose.
I think the fish balls that fall under the processed foods category where, you're not getting any real fish in there.
It's mostly flour.
It's mostly flour.
Starch. You know, and sodium.
The fish cakes, the seafood balls that really don't have any definable animal source in there. Other processed foods include nuggets, of course, like you said, burgers, sausages feature a lot. Of course, as you mentioned, Yahua, a lot of the sweetened and sugary things. Junk foods such as chips and keropok. Coffee and tea appears on the list as well. And
they were allowed to sell that at school? I didn't know that.
In the canteen, yeah, why not? I mean, whether they actually sell it.
Coffee and tea for kids.
Well, they may not be selling it just for kids, right?
Oh, right.
Teachers
will
go there and order it too, no?
Well, in my school, teachers had a separate room and food served to them separately. So I do believe that coffee and tea shouldn't be made available to children, if that's what this implies. Do you think that children should be drinking?
No, I don't think so.
Tea.
Although I did start drinking coffee at a very young age, but I don't think that was a good idea.
I'm trying to get what the criteria for all this banned food. Why do they not allow coffee and tea?
I think it's the caffeine that I would be more worried about.
And I think that if kids are to be drinking anything, why drink something that doesn't offer any additional nutrients anyway? Obviously, coffee and tea are not the only ones. We're also talking about cordial drinks and sweetened syrups, 3-in-1 mixed drinks, a lot of energy isotonic drinks as well.
Now I'm interested to see what the canteen would look like after this.
Serves water and milk, at least 3 types of fresh fruit, 3 types of vegetable dishes. It serves fat-free meat, skinless chicken, and that less than 50% of the meal should be oily and high fat. That's, I suppose, more an advice towards the kind of principles that should be adopted rather than real food examples.
Okay, so since we've not stepped foot in a secondary school in over a decade or maybe two.
More.
You spoke to a parent with 3 children in a government primary school for her opinion on food variety in canteens, yes?
This lack of vegetables and proper protein food available, because most of the time it's carbs and junk food and processed food. Like snacks, like little individual packets of chips and chocolates and sweets and lollipops. Then the processed food, like they will sell sausages, fish cake, because I don't give my kids allowances to bring to school. Like they don't get pocket money to go to school. But their friends will be buying all this junk food and they'll be sharing with the other kids. It's a big concern because then they don't eat the packed food that we bring.
I also spoke to Dr. T.E. Seong, who's the president of the Nutrition Society of Malaysia, to find out the role that schools play in nurturing eating habits among children. And I should probably make a disclaimer here that Dr. T is also my father, which is where I learned a lot of my healthy eating habits.
It's a fact that the schools can be a very important place to impart education on healthy lifestyle to a young child. So school children are at an impressionable state age, and it is recognized by many health authorities that this school can be an excellent avenue for imparting nutrition education, as school canteens can play that role, in my view. And if we have a wrong type of food sold in the school canteens, this will send a wrong message to the child that, well, these foods are okay, the schools are selling them, so it's probably okay to eat them.
So clearly there seems to be a very strong onus on the canteen operators to be controlling the kind of food that they sell. And in fact, the guidelines that we mentioned at the top of this story are not new, and several iterations of them have been around for at least 20 years. Dr. Noor Hisham also said in the report that efforts to healthify school canteens began in 2016 in collaboration with the Education Ministry under the purview of the National Plan of Action for Nutrition of Malaysia 2016 to 2025. He said canteen operators have been monitored since 2012. So if guidelines have been in place, enforcement activities have been carried out, why do parents like Ina earlier still see the kind of foods that their children are exposed to? And William Hui, Association of School Canteen Operators of Malaysia, concurred. He says these problems have been occurring for decades, and this is what he had to add.
Since 76 up to now, 40 years, 42, yeah. I have visited 4,000 of the school, and I see a lot of canteens lack of knowledge on this food. Some canteens, they are not canteen operators, that's the whole problem. They sub to some canteen operators, they don't even know how to cook. So they just engage the workers and then they just do some fried meat or nasi lemak or something like that. And it's very unhygiene also.
Interesting. How do you get a canteen operating license?
From anecdotal evidence, William did mention, and I've heard from several other sources as well, the license is given out by tender and the decision is made by the school principals.
Huh. And based on what criteria?
Presumably, competitiveness in the bid would be the deciding factor. Although, then you wonder whether there's enough transparency in the process. Yeah.
I don't even know what to add to that, because now I'm wondering, how do these canteen operators get the license to operate the canteen? You seem to not have the knowledge to even cook or...
Exactly, yes.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. Anyway, William also spoke a bit on enforcement.
This time, I hope the enforcement doing their job. If they really do their job, I think the canteen operator will follow. That's why the enforcement problem also. Last time, yeah, they are very strict. The enforcement come to the canteen, they check the food, and then they take back and analyze it, and then they summon us. When we make noise about 10 years, 1986, they stop the summon already. They want to catch the source. Source, I mean the producer, to send the kuih tiao, drinks, that means the manufacturer. Can't stop the manufacturer, then how to stop? The canteen don't sell, they sell the koperasi, they sell the hawkers.
This is a bit like Tai Chi.
Yes.
Like you're pushing it here and then authorities have to enforce the rule and then supplier. So who's...
Actually, think about it. It is strange. Like, actually, the gate should be You know, if the principal makes the decision, the principal can then just be the gate, right? The government authorities don't have to come by all the time to do their enforcement of the check because the schools can check it themselves, right? And then I'll just take away your license and I'm just going to look for another canteen operator. I think that should be easy enough, isn't it?
Another problem that has been a complaint as well, apparently, is the fact that these unhealthy foods are sold outside of school grounds. They claim that they are
just outside the gate.
Just outside the gate, targeting kids as they leave school.
That's childhood memory. That's childhood memory.
I know.
Take that away from us.
And of course, then, whose purview is it to regulate the hawkers? That would be a town council issue, I believe. And
they should not be, 50 metres within the vicinity of a school?
And, you know, at the end of the day, if kids are not getting it right outside the school when they're walking home, you know, it could be one of the shops along the way.
Yeah, 50 metres is too short a distance to stop me from going to get that fried fish ball or something.
Yeah, it's just really on that
quick
fried fish ball.
Yeah. Detour, right? So now, okay, it's not the canteen operators, it's not the authorities, apparently. So what, it's the suppliers and the manufacturers.
So as you said, it's a little bit of Tai Chi going on here. The other party that's involved in this whole scenario is the supplier side. And they are represented by the Malaysia Foodstuffs and Toy Merchants Associations. Many of their members include those who supply snack and confectionery. So a lot of those products appear in school canteens. However, when I spoke to Chong Shan Yong, the president of the association, he had a different view of what their role is.
Our members are the traders, they are the importers, and also some manufacturers. Maybe that comes under the purview of the association of the canteen operators, because my members don't have direct contact with the canteen operators. They do, I mean, in terms of selling, it's just a trade.
Well, there you go. That's a bit of a...
Now we're back to the canteen operators.
That's right. And I also asked Chong what he thinks about the list of foods that are to be banned, and this was his response.
I think the notion and intent of the guideline is good. Obesity among school-going children are actually quite serious and on the rise. But I think maybe it's a little bit of an overkill. You look at the list of the banned foods, it pretty cover maybe 80% of what is being served right now in the canteens, you know. As far as I'm concerned, I have three school-going children or so. I could see that actually the canteen has already cut down tremendously on especially like high-calorie food and high sugar content products are actually being cut down, especially snacks. But if you're talking about banning it totally, might not be feasible and might not be practical. So because actually there's a lot of food peddlers outside of the school.
Yeah. Actually, I quite agree with what Chong San Yong said just now. That it's I think if I were the traders, I would also think that this is purely a demand and supply issue. Mm. I'm only contributing the service and I'm only supplying it. And the canteen operators, if you tell me that, hey, I do not want this junk food from now on, I am going to sell some other thing. Yeah, I can get you those other things. I mean, it may come at a higher price. You know, I'm not sure if it comes at a higher price, but if it is, and you want it, I'm going to sell it to you and I'll still make... My business will still be there, right? So I don't see why the traders should be put to blame. And his point on that, it's an overkill. Well, I think that points more to, wow, like 80% of our food now is deserves to be banned by the industry.
That's a bigger issue here.
It's incredible.
The parents' concerns about school canteen food is that it's outside of their control. You know, it's the time when you can't keep an eye on them. So what you hope is for them to be able to... You want to teach them to make the right decisions, of course. But if there's a plethora of it available, all their friends are eating it, they're going to be tempted.
Yeah. Okay, so what's the better approach to nutrition in schools, at least?
Schools can still play a role, but in terms of the broader approach of educating and inculcating habits, rather than just leaving it to canteen operators who, as we've just heard, may not even be properly trained operators at all. So Dr. T had a suggestion.
For example, posters on healthy eating, messages can be placed on a school canteen. Activities related to food and nutrition can conduct games, competitions, making use of the school canteen. So they serve much more wider use than just merely providing food to the child. So I would really suggest that nutritionists be assigned to schools and they can carry out the activities that I just mentioned. For example, monitor the BMI, if underweight, overweight, make proper referrals to the health centers or health doctors. The nutritionists can monitor the food sold in school canteens, conduct nutrition education activities, put a lot of interest on food and nutrition, and it becomes very important. I recognize that it's not easy to assign nutritionists to every school in this country at the stage of development of this country. Maybe we start on a smaller scale. For example, one nutritionist look after 5 primary schools to kick off this kind of program.
I like that idea. We're going to have 2 to 3 counselors in every school and a nutritionist in every school.
We'll have perfect children.
Yes, yes. I'm optimistic about the future now.
And at the end of the day, I think when we can't depend on the school system and the canteens, what do parents do? They take matters into their own hands, as Ina does.
I usually let them bring bread, sandwiches, egg muffins to bring for the morning snack. And if they have to stay back for lunch, we will maybe make some food that can last, like chicken wraps or sushi wraps, some fried noodles. At least we can control the toppings we put in the food. It is a lot of effort, but you feel more at ease that my kids are actually eating proper food when they go to school or healthier food, especially when they need the proper energy to stay focused in school.
So, school's out?
School's out? Nope, not yet. We're going to go, I don't know, detention now, I guess.
No, high achievers, high achievers. We're going to look at the high achievers now.
To the fast track class. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
The Health News Digest on the Bigger Picture. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to Health News Digest. I'm Tina Camellia, and in the studio with me are Ti Xiao Yik and Lau Yahua. We're going back to school this episode, beginning with providing mental health services in schools, improving canteen food quality, and now we're going to find out how kids are co-authoring scientific papers.
All right, so apparently the South Korean government is investigating 82 academic papers, which the authors had named their children or relatives, many of them who were still in middle or high school, as co-authors on the publications. Now, the Education Ministry started their investigation sometime late 2017, and they looked at articles written by more than 70,000 full-time university staff members across arts and sciences over the past decade. They discovered 82 papers from 29 Korean universities that had, among their authors, a child or children. And in 39 of these papers, the child author actually participated in the research as part of a program in which the universities work with the middle and high schools to help the students write research papers. So this seemed legit. The other 43 papers did not seem to have any valid reason for the children to be listed as co-authors. Now, so far, what universities were implicated in this investigation? Some of Seoul's most elite universities, including Sungkyu Kwan University, Yonsei University, Seoul National University, and Kukmin University.
So we've all done our postgraduate studies and research. So we all know how the process of writing a paper and getting published.
You're high achievers here too.
The question is, how old were you?
No, I was an adult or now adolescent based on the new
new guidelines.
Perhaps you can briefly describe that process.
You are first looking for journals that would be fit for your field of study, and then submitting your draft, you're waiting for someone to come back to you. Or sometimes you have to pay first, and then you're waiting for them to come back to you to say, we are reviewing it and it needs corrections. And sometimes this correction is 2-3 rounds of corrections. And this whole process can take, 5 to 9 months? It can take over a year from the submission to actually getting a yes. Not necessarily getting published yet. And that is just, it's a very tiring process.
What about you, Yahua? You don't seem as reluctant about this process.
Doesn't seem to be as traumatized.
No, I wasn't traumatized at all. I learned quickly. I did not
learn at all. This is why I don't have a DR in front of my name and he does. This is the difference between us.
Well, no, what I learned was I learned to accept rejection really quickly.
Oh yeah, that's fine. Yeah. You see, that's what bothered me the most, is I just need a yes or a no so I can move on.
It's true that it can be a very tedious and long process, and you could very likely go through several rounds with the same journal or with different journals, right? Starting, it seems like you have to start the whole process again because Every journal has a different format or has a different emphasis, and you have to do it again and again. And some people would get too tired, but it is the requirement for us to graduate.
Yeah, and I think for tenured researchers, it's part of the requirement to maintain tenure as well, right? But I wonder, does that arduous process defeat the purpose of publishing, which is to share your results and your findings?
This is why I am not an academician.
And you are not a radio presenter.
Well, there is actually a way to play the game. How do you optimize what names to put on? Mm. And even like for a young starting scientist, is it to your benefit to have a senior, way senior co-author? Or is it detrimental to your career? You know, and there are different ways that they have analyzed this. If I remember correctly, if you're just starting out, it's good to tag along with one of the senior ones.
How easy it is for these kids to already have co-authored papers before they even step into a research setting.
Mm.
Back to this news report itself, they say that they're investigating 82 papers now, right? Of which almost half had valid reason to list the children as co-authors, whereas the larger half did not seem to have any valid reasons. I guess we need to discuss a bit about what qualifies you as a co-author. So I think there are different guidelines. To be one of the co-authors, you need to have contributed to either designing the study, analyzing the data, collecting the data, writing the first draft, and had a say in approving the final draft. And in fact, you have to have done all of this to qualify as a co-author. And right off the top of my mind, I can remember many, many authors, not my co-authors, but many, many authors who would not qualify at all. It's a sad thing. But
so this is a rampant practice?
Just generally in the academic world, this publish or perish drive to... Mm. You just need to publish X number of papers per year.
Yeah, it's not just the number of papers. It's also the journals that your papers land in, right?
Yes.
And it's actually quite a relatively new pressure. I would say probably in the last 1.5 or 2 decades that has come by with all this impact factor, you know, like how impactful a journal is and how many times your paper is cited by other researchers. Mm. Some quarters think that that actually indicates how good or how meaningful or how influential your paper is.
Yeah.
And that's definitely up to debate, you know, using the citation or the impact factor as an indicator of quality. That's definitely debatable.
And unfortunately, opens it up to abuse.
Yeah. But these kids, though, I don't think they will understand.
well, they will, because they want to enter university,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's right.
Once they get in, then they will say, wow, you know, it's, you know, I'm not sure how many of these kids, you know, the investigation hasn't ended yet, right?
Yeah.
It hasn't ended. So how many of these children actually contributed to the paper itself? You know, we can't really conclude on that.
I think as part of the investigation as well, they will be looking at those children who did not contribute to the papers and striking them off the university admissions, if they are trying to use that on the basis of having co-authored, supposedly.
The whole point of this is so that they have an edge when it comes to being admitted to university.
Apparently,
but
yes.
Now it's going to backfire.
It's going to backfire.
Fair enough. Now I'm okay.
Yeah, do you know like how stressful it is to enter like those South Korean universities?
I don't know.
It's crazy. Yeah, yeah, I was just reading a book and in it they describe the hours. They really go by meritocracy. So the top tier goes into like the best middle schools, and then from there you go into the best high schools. And then from there, you go into like the elite South Korean universities, and then your life is set, right? You get higher pay, and everything is like great, yeah. And so, in preparing for the exam, they go to school at 8 o'clock and then they end sometime like 8 o'clock in the evening. Mm. Of course, there are breaks in between. I'm not sure what the next or anything. But
canteen food.
But they don't go home. Then they go for these tuition centres until like 11 or 10 at night. And then they go home, sleep a few hours, then start the next day again. Mm. Can you blame them for wanting to like find the extra edge? It's crazy, yeah.
They need nutritionists and clinical psychologists in their schools.
And counsellors,
yes. But okay, to be fair, there are child scientists who have published papers. Most recently, 8-year-old Sophia, who's an amateur entomologist, co-authored a paper in the Annals of the Entomological Society of America. This happened in September 2017.
So she loved insects and
she was like you.
Yeah, just like me. Except that my name is very Asian sounding. I definitely did not publish a paper when I was 8. But like 8 years old, Sophia, she likes to have, you know, insects that she carries around in school, and she got teased and bullied by her classmates and schoolmates for it. And so her mom, you know, wrote to the Canadian Entomological Society and asking for help, you know, like, could any of your entomologists speak to my daughter and help her out in this? And what came out of that was a social media storm, a nice shower on Twitter, where a lot of people tweeted back onto this hashtag called Bugs Are For Girls. And then they gave her lots of support and they directly contacted Sophia to give her guidance on how she can nurture her love for insects. And so one of the people involved took this scenario and wrote it up as part of a study looking at science communication and how science can be communicated through Twitter and how scientists can better use Twitter to communicate their science. And so, yeah, so I guess this story had a happy ending for Sophia and for all the insects that she has been carrying around.
In fact, Sophia was listed as a co-author because she actually did write a section in the paper, and I just wanted to read a couple of lines from it. It starts off, "My favourite bugs are snails, slugs and caterpillars, but my favourite one of all is grasshoppers." And she also talks about, you know, being a girl who likes bugs. She says, "If somebody said bugs weren't for girls, I would be really mad at them. But I wouldn't do anything. I would just not talk to them. I think other girls who saw my story would like to study bugs too."
Yeah, so she got, so she was listed as a co-author. That paper has only 2 authors, and so she was the second one. It's all nice and stuff, but I would say, you know, based on the criteria of co-authors that I actually described just now, I don't think Sophia actually qualifies.
Oh, you're harsh.
I would say no. I guess based on those criteria, where she actually had to carry out the design, write the paper, approve the final, and she had to understand the paper before she can approve the final version, right?
Right. Do not submit your manuscripts to any journals that Yahua is an editor of.
Yeah.
Or a peer
reviewer. That's the moral of the story.
Good for you guys, there's no such journal.
That's all the time we have this hour. I hope you enjoyed the show. If you miss any part of the conversation, you can always download the podcast on our BFM app, available on Google Play and the Apple App Store. I'm Tina Camellia, joined by Ti Xiao Yik and Lau Yahua. This is The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.